Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ari Kritchever, registration 37780, and I represent the appellant Laura Cervantes. I raised three issues on appeal, and I'm happy to answer questions about any of those. I'd like to focus my argument today on the second part of the second and the third issue that I raised in the opening brief. The second issue that I raised deals with the failure of the district court to ensure that the jury reached a unanimous verdict. There was evidence at trial of two separate time frames in which the baby was injured. The first was around March 27th and 28th, when the baby was taken to the hospital and treated for symptoms that they believed at the time were related to pneumonia. And then, of course, we have the events around April 6th, which unfortunately the baby did not recover from. And in the instructions to the jury was not required, the prosecution was not required to elect an injury it was relying on, and the jury was not required to select which injury it was relying on in finding Ms. Cervantes guilty. There was testimony that, and I think we would agree that there was testimony that once an individual suffers a brain injury, that while that brain injury is healing, it is easier to re-injure the brain again. And the analogy that they used at trial is that you have a cut and you have a scab, and then the simple act of brushing against the table can pull that scab off and you can re-injure that. Whereas if there had not been an injury there before, brushing against the table would not have hurt you at all. And I think that analogy is directly on point. We have an injury here that occurred, and there's some evidence that an injury occurred while the baby was in the care of Ms. Cervantes, but then the baby was also in the care of a number of other people before he ended up in the hospital. He was treated for a couple of days, and then he was released. And then we have the injury later on April 6th that I assume the court is familiar with. And the Attorney General, points in their answer brief to a question that the jury raised, which I think actually makes the point very well. The jury asked a question that was ultimately not answered by the district court. The jury asked a question of whether the injury on March 27th or 28th by itself would have been a fatal injury, you know, sort of ignoring the April 6th injury. And I think that makes the point very well, because the fact is that there was an injury on April 6th. We do have two separate injuries. And Ms. Cervantes was convicted of causing an injury. She was not convicted of the pattern of conduct portion of the offense, but specifically of causing an injury. And nowhere does the jury tell us which injury they were relying on. And this is especially troubling to me because of what I raised in the third issue, which is the instruction and the failure of the instruction to track the language of the statute. And for that issue, I think we can start from an agreement that the instruction did not track the language of the statute and did not track the direction of the Colorado stock jury instruction. There are two different ways that Ms. Cervantes was charged with committing child abuse in this case, and the first was by causing an injury, and the second was this pattern of conduct charge. And the language from the statute, if you put together the injury and the result, the language of the statute reads that you're guilty of child abuse if you cause an injury that results in death, or if you engage in a pattern of conduct that ultimately results in death. And the key word there is the word ultimately. In the instruction to the jury, what the jury actually found, what they selected on their verdict form, was that they were finding her guilty of causing an injury that ultimately resulted in death. Now, this is kind of a hybrid combination of the two different forms of committing this offense.
Don't both ways have to result in the death of the child, ultimately?
Well, that's important.
Don't both have to result in the death of the child?
That's correct.
Okay. So you can't leave out the latter part of the sentence when you're looking at either the recklessly or the knowing Isn't that true?
No, and I think that this is separate from the mens rea issue that I raised in the brief about knowing and reckless. This has more to do with inserting the word ultimately. The phrase ultimately results in death, specifically with the word ultimately in the statute, is only attached to the pattern of conduct theory of liability.
Sorry, okay. But doesn't it also, if the direct as opposed to the pattern of conduct, it's one instance, doesn't that also have to result in death of the child in order to be, for a conviction to happen under the statute?
Yes. Well, as it was presented in this case, yes. And I phrase it that way because...
Isn't that the way the crime is proven regardless of how it's presented in this case? You can't get a conviction for it unless it ultimately results in death.
You could get a conviction for causing an injury that does not result in death. It would be a lesser class of felony if it resulted in serious bodily injury or plain bodily injury or something other than bodily injury. There is still, when you go to the result portion of the statute and it outlines the level of offense, depends on the injury that ultimately resulted.
But for what this defendant was charged with?
Yes. Yes, that's
even
correct.
If it wasn't shown as a pattern of conduct, even if it was one isolated incident, it still had to result in death in order for there to be conviction, correct?
Yes.
So how can we not read that ultimately resulting in death piece for both parts of the statute, both parts of the charge?
The key word is ultimately, and I think that we have to believe that the legislature made an intentional decision to phrase it differently as it relates to the pattern of conduct as opposed to how it relates to the causing an injury.
And what do you have to back that up?
We have, I think there are two cases that are very instructive. Very recently, the Supreme Court decided Kaufman, where the jury was incorrectly instructed that it was a self-defense issue, and the jury was incorrectly instructed that the defendant had to believe that the initial aggressors had an intent to cause serious bodily injury, when in fact the initial aggressors only had to have an intent to cause regular bodily injury. And the insertion of that word serious, the modifier serious, was enough to constitute plain error because it lessened, in that case, it lessened the prosecution's burden in terms of disproving the affirmative defense. It made it easier for them to disprove the affirmative defense. And the other case, Weinreich, which is at 119 P3rd 1073, also Colorado Supreme Court from 2005. And this dealt with actually the child abuse statute as well. And there's a lot of talk in there about that the instruction in that case used language from an outdated version of the statute. But what's important is the reasoning. The language that they used was that child abuse was committed when you engage in conduct that may endanger the safety of a child. And they looked back to an earlier case, Hohl, H-O-E-H-L, which is at 568 P2nd 484, where they talked about the word may. And just adding that word may separated the defendant's conduct from the result enough to render that statute unconstitutional. And in order to constitutionalize the statute then, they had to craft a new definition for the word may because the regular definition of the word may was too speculative and allowed for too much of a gap. And that's exactly what we have here. The court inserted the word ultimately into the definition of this crime. And it, going back to the unanimity issue, it invited the jury to potentially rely on the earlier injury. And so we have no idea if the jury convicted her of causing the earlier injury and then causing a later injury that aggravated that injury, which would have ultimately resulted in death. I think the bottom line I'm getting to is that the way the legislature crafted the statute, it intended for there to be a much more direct causation when you're going to convict someone of causing an injury that results in death. Does not have the word ultimately in there. And it suggests a direct result, as opposed to the pattern of conduct theory of liability, which says engaging a pattern of conduct that ultimately results in death, which suggests, you know, I think the way that's used is you have a number of otherwise non-fatal injuries, but the cumulative result of those injuries, the ultimate result, is death. And I think this is right in line with the Supreme Court's findings in Weinreich and in Kaufman. And it's exactly actually what the Attorney General put in their answer brief, that there is a lower standard of cause and effect if you're going to charge someone with the pattern of conduct version of child abuse, as opposed to the causing an injury, if you will, version of child abuse.
Counsel, so I think, assuming that
go ahead.
The error that you're arguing for, wasn't the evidence still overwhelming in this case, as even conceded by the defendant? Didn't the defendant admit to shaking the baby, and the baby immediately stopped breathing or was short of breath, that the baby was then rushed to the hospital and never really recovered from that, and that she regretted being angry at the time?
You're correct that there's not a dispute about what occurred on April 6th. However, it does not, the Attorney General's argument that there was overwhelming evidence does not take into account exactly what I'm suggesting, which is that perhaps the jury decided that the April 6th injury aggravated the March 27th injury, and if not for that earlier injury, the baby would not have responded so severely as it did on April 6th.
If the jury was considering a cumulative impact, wouldn't the jury more likely have checked the other box?
They certainly could have, but the way that they were instructed doesn't make that entirely clear, because they certainly could, because of the way it was worded, causing an injury that ultimately results in death. If they had decided that the earlier injury then aggravated by the later injury, it's hard to know. It's hard to speculate about what they could have done had they been instructed correctly.
And on the instruction issue, is that a plain error issue?
Yes, it is.
How clear does the error have to be? In other words, when you say it's not clear, well, who has the burden of showing what was clear?
Well, I think what's not clear is what the jury might have done had they been instructed correctly. I think that the error was very clear. We have the statute, and the language in the statute, I mean, it's right there. We have a Colorado jury instruction that lays out in great detail how the jury should be instructed, how they, you know, they should be given a special,
Any deviation from a Colorado jury instruction or statute is clear error.
Not any deviation, but I'm not sure how else to put it other than that it doesn't track the language of the statute, and just looking at one or the other would be plain to anyone, I think, looking at those that the language is different, and which is exactly the situation in Weinreich and exactly the situation in Kaufman, where we have instructions not tracking the language of the statute, and that was plain error.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time.
Well, you have a minute, 21 seconds.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, and I represent the people in this matter. I wanted to just start with the third issue, the claim of instructional error with respect to the elemental instruction. I was looking at my brief because as I was listening to counsel's argument, I wanted to make sure that I was clear about this. I didn't write in my brief that the jury instruction differed from the statute. What differed here is the jury instruction given didn't match the pattern instruction. It actually does, and I tried to lay this out in my brief. The way the jury instruction was given, it tracks the statute, but the organization of it was different from the pattern instruction. So it's, and I tried to make that clear, that it leads to several absurd results if we only include the ultimately results in the death with respect to the third way of committing child abuse. But I urge this court that that issue doesn't need to be decided today, because I think that there was overwhelming evidence that the defendant's conduct on April 6th was the direct cause of the death of this baby. And I think that directly ties into my argument with respect to unanimity, with respect to the injury caused. We know from the verdict form that this jury was given that they were either going to be relying on a single injury or a pattern of conduct. And there's no question that the jury rejected the pattern of conduct. There's evidence of two different events, the March 27th incident that the defendant explained about that possible head bumping, and then there was the April 6th incident, which the defendant confessed that she got angry, she picked the baby up from a car seat on the floor, and she shook him, and his head went back and forth, and his eyes closed, he had difficulty breathing, he was in a coma that day, and then he died.
Who injected the issue about the March 27th or 28th head bumping? Did the prosecution introduce evidence of that first?
My understanding was that the prosecution did introduce that evidence because that was part of their theory with respect to the pattern. But I submit to this court that when we know that the jury rejected the pattern, the only reasonable understanding of what the jury did in this case is that they found the April 6th incident was the cause of the baby's death. And I think that is supported by the evidence.
So how do you respond to your counterpart's assertion or the analogy of the scab that came off or sort of eggshell?
Yeah, you know, and I've been thinking a lot about that issue because it seems to me that it's not, you know, in reading the defendant's reply brief and hearing his argument today, it doesn't seem like even a unanimity issue, because I think if the prosecution were asked in this case, what injury are you relying upon for that subparagraph 3A, they would have said, we're relying on the April 6th incident. It almost seems more like a tort concept of the eggshell skull baby that he was vulnerable based on the March 27th incident. And I submit to you that second injury was the cause of the baby's death. And I think, you know, I think you take your victim as you find him. And there's no question that both doctors, both the coroner and another child abuse specialist who testified, said that earlier injury was not fatal. And I just don't think that there's any question, looking at the evidence presented in this case and what happened to that baby after the defendant shook him on April 6th, that was the cause of his death.
Was there any evidence that earlier injury did not contribute to his death?
You know, I think that draws me to that question that the jury asked about whether that first injury was fatal, and we know that it wasn't fatal. I can't give you, I think, you know, in reading through all of that medical evidence, that there was still symptoms of the earlier injury. But the fact remains that the baby died because of what the defendant did on April 6th. If the court has no further questions, the people would rest on the brief with respect to the first issue.
Thank you.
I ask you to affirm the conviction. Thank you.
I just want to make two real quick points. The first one is just wanted to point out the Attorney General's argument that somehow the instruction matches the language of the statute. And we've been over this in pretty great detail in my initial argument. But the way that the jury convicted Ms. Cervantes, causing an injury that ultimately results in death, is nowhere in the statute. Those words in that order are just not in the statute. The word ultimately is only in the statute relating to the pattern of conduct theory of liability. And I just would like to respond very briefly to the Attorney General's final comment that the baby died because of what the defendant did on April 6th. To me, is sort of an argument of, well, you know, she did do it, didn't she? Which I think is a bit crass. And, I think that's the whole issue here, is that something took place on March 27th and 28th, something took place on April 6th, and then the baby died. And the jury was never instructed in a way to allow them to consider how those events relate to each other. If there are no further questions, I would ask to reverse the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel.